It is the Boyack Review, as we do every Tuesday at 2:30. Got Connor, and Connor is talking about economics, about this looming January 1st, 2013. How are we going to pay for Obamacare? Hi, Connor, are you there?
I am, Jake. How are you?
I'm doing good. Yeah, I'm not looking forward to the first of the year, by the way.
Right. I don't know that anyone is. And it's an interesting question to ask how we're going to pay for it. Of course, we're not. Right? I mean, there's taxes, and there's fines, and there's, you know, all this other funky, you know, budgetary business that's going on. But ultimately, we're talking about financing this in the short term upon the long term, the shoulders of our children and grandchildren. And that's assuming there's no massive default or collapse or any other thing that would wipe out the staggering debt that we're accumulating here. What I find interesting with this, when we talk about Obamacare, is the numbers that are thrown around. I mean, you're a numbers guy, and just a few minutes ago, you're talking about these quadrillions and these insane numbers that are just so astronomical, they really can't even be comprehended. I mean,
anytime a word that rhymes with
Ilian
comes out, it's like people just glaze over. They have no concept, really, what the scope and magnitude of these
numbers
are.
Not at all. And, you know, I've seen some interesting visualizations on the internet where they show, like, here's a guy standing next to this many $100 bills, and this is how much money this equals, and here's these stacks of $100 bills, and now it's a football field, and now it's the size of the Empire State Building. And that still doesn't even come anywhere close to what Obamacare alone is kind of involving itself with monetarily, let alone all of the other, you know, foreign policy and domestic welfare and everything else that the government is spending money on. These illions that you talk about are just so staggering that it almost... The people who push these programs can actually take advantage of the incomprehensibility of the numbers, right? Because if people don't understand the egregious amount that a trillion or even a billion or whatever actually is, it's more difficult for them to kind of mentally oppose that and therefore kind of counter and oppose the program that's trying to be passed. What I want to talk about instead, though, is not just the staggering sum of the amount of money required itself, but the methodology that's used to kind of to fudge the numbers, as it were, and try and get passage of these programs by short-selling them financially. There's been some interesting reports that have come out a couple months ago, I think. It was the Small Business Administration. They came out with a $1.7 trillion estimate for the regulatory compliances of Obamacare. And, of course, the White House distances itself from this number, saying it's not accurate and saying it doesn't match their figures. Now, recall, at least for some sort of context with these illions that we're talking about, that the total GDP for the United States is around $15 trillion. And so here's this estimate saying that Obamacare alone, the financial impact on an annual basis is $1.7 trillion. So all this controversy and, oh, this, you know, number just can't be accurate because, of course, the health and Human Services Department and the other agencies within the government that are tasked with creating these budgets and these cost projections come in far lower. And yet we have a second witness that came out just days ago from this libertarian group called the Competitive Enterprise Institute. I actually hadn't heard of them before.
Yeah, I've heard of them. They're great guys.
So, and I should look more into them. And so they came out with a $1.8 trillion annual estimate for the federal regulations plus those coming under Obamacare. The cost to the American taxpayer, according to these guys, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, is $1.8 trillion. So very close to the $1.7 trillion that the Small Business Administration was coming up with.
Now, to give people the aliens scope, I was able to look this up, okay? 1 million seconds, that's 12 days, okay? 1 billion seconds is 32 years. 1 trillion seconds is 31,688 years. I mean, people don't understand how these magnitudes multiply. A quadrillion, I don't even want to know how much a quadrillion is, and that's the outstanding derivatives debt. I mean, it's like, anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think it gives some scope.
That's important to understand, especially when the government tries to do what it does to get those illions into play. So, for example, we talk about this $1.8 trillion, and assuming that these guys are correct, because, of course, any private institute, even if they have their bias, is going to be more correct than the government, which is just so saturated with bias, it's just ridiculous to believe any of the figures that they put out.
Yeah,
so, of
partisan, course, you have the partisan nonsense.
Right, and so you have the government, of course, put out their estimates of the regulatory compliance and the tax burden of Obamacare. What's their number? $88 billion. Now, of course, that on itself is just a staggering sum. It's a ton of money. But when you compare $88 billion, which is the government's estimate, to $1.8 trillion, which are these two private market estimates that we've now seen, that's 20 times more than what the government claimed that Obamacare was going to cost on an annual basis. This is how the government historically has been able to do what it does, by and large, to pass these massive programs that are extremely costly, is to simply short sell them and say, well, we're going to get all of this for this amazing price. It's only going to cost this much. When historically that has not been the case at all, as we'll get into on the other side of the break.
All right, cool. Guys, we're in the middle of the Boyack Review talking about the true cost of Obamacare and how in the heck, what does that mean even? These numbers are so huge. All right, come on back, guys. Welcome back, guys. I've been thinking about Obamacare, unfortunately, for way too long. And Connor Boyack, too, he's on the phone talking about what's this going to cost us. Connor, are you still there?
I am.
Okay, good. So, the commercials come and go. Can't control those. Where were you before they got...
For those who are just jumping on the show, we're talking about the compliance costs, the cost to the American taxpayers of Obamacare, which is shortly all these regulations are going to kick in. And I should actually qualify what we were talking about before. It's easy to conflate kind of the tax burden that's involved or even fines with simply the regulatory compliance costs that are involved with the intervention of the government into the market. That's what we're actually talking about. We're not talking about the taxes that are involved and how much taxes are going up. These figures that we're talking about where the government estimated $88 billion annually and two private sector groups are calculating it between $1.7 and $1.8 trillion annually. That's not tax dollars, tax revenue we're talking about. That is the burden upon the private market for simply having to comply with the regulations, which, I should also note, are not yet even complete. A lot of these regulations are still being written. Of course, Obamacare was 2,400 pages. The regulations are already in the tens and thousands. A lot of these regulations kick in not until 2014. So many of them are still being written. We're not able to quantify how much money is going to be required by the marketplace to be able to even comply with these regulations. That's the figure that we're talking about. What I want to talk about specifically, as we got into before the break, is the method that has historically been used by government to pass these big government programs. These numbers are staggering, they're incomprehensible, and yet even the government knows that if they start throwing out even, too big of numbers and those become the talking points for these programs, that can sink a program. So they use all their budgetary tricks, just like they do with the unemployment figures and the inflation figures. Of course, CPI was totally manipulated back in the Clinton days. These numbers are just fudged to allow for a more politically favorable outcome. And so here we have with Obamacare, the government saying $88 billion per year, and now we have these private groups saying, no, it's actually 20 times more than that, and that's even a conservative estimate, as this one group, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, said. They said it's probably going to be even more than that. The $1.8 trillion figure is quite defensible on its own, but it's going to be even bigger than that, and there's no way to quantify how much bigger because so many of these regulations are yet to be written and announced. So the method by which government is able to more favorably and easily pass these big programs is simply to minimize the projected costs that are involved. We've seen this throughout history. As I mentioned right before we were going into the break, this has been done with other big government programs. I found a fascinating article on Reason.com from a few years back. They were talking about a book about Lyndon B. Johnson, who was talking about the outright lies that were used to get Medicare through Congress. And they featured an interview with James Monroe on NPR, who's the co-author of this book I'm talking about, that details some of LBJ's interventions. And it has actually a segment from Lyndon B. Johnson as president encouraging a then young Senator Ted Kennedy to basically lie with these numbers in order to get big government programs passed. And what I found interesting was Reason has an article where they talk about some of these historical examples where, in the case of Medicare, it was, in fact, I think I have it right here, So this is what the Reason.com article says. A further concern is that initial cost estimates of federal health programs are usually very optimistic. When Medicare was launched in 1965, Part A was projected to cost $9 billion by 1990, $9 billion, but ended up costing $67 billion. When Medicaid's special hospital subsidy was added in 1987, it was supposed to cost $100 million annually, but it already cost $11 billion just 5 years later. When Medicare's home care benefit was added in 88, it was projected to cost $4 billion over the next 5 years, in 1993, but it ended up costing not $4 billion, but $10 billion. This goes on and on. I mean, we can talk about Social Security. That's a staggering one where they totally had this, like, lofty vision of what it's going to cost 20, 30, 40 years down the road. They make all these assumptions that they simply can't make, and they get it passed because, oh, look, it's not going to cost that much money, and look at the wonderful help we're going to be able to give these poor, sick, and old people, so let's go ahead and do it. This is a very consistent practice and consistent outcome with the government. We're seeing it again with Obamacare. It doesn't, of course, apply just to health programs. It applies to really anything that the government's trying to do where they simply undersell what was done. We see it even with the budget, of course. You know, all these assumptions that are made by the government to, of course, whenever they actually decide to do budgets, which they haven't done in several years now. But what they do is you look at Obama's plan from a few years ago. You look at Paul Ryan's plan in contrast that he passed, kind of as a competitive budget to President Obama's. And they're making all these forecasts for the future that they simply have no way of controlling, let alone foreseeing. And so you have Obama saying that his budget projects $46 trillion in spending over the next decade, $46 trillion. And then you have Paul Ryan saying, oh, we're going to do way better than that, and he reduces it from $46 trillion to $40 trillion, right? And these are increases over where we're at right now. And the problem that we see here with these budgets, forecasting into the future and creating these short-term supposed gains over the long-term negative consequences, is that they simply cannot control what a future Congress is going to do. They say, well, if we make these assumptions that unemployment, you know, remains this way and regulatory compliance is this and tax rates this and yada, 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 therefore here's the number. But, of course, they have no way of controlling what a future Congress is going to do, what a future president's going to do, what new programs they're going to want to pass. So these assumptions are completely ridiculous. They have no basis in being factored into any legitimate numbers, and therefore all of the government numbers that they try and offer up, as they did with this $88 billion with Obamacare, simply cannot be relied upon at all, because there's absolutely no reliance whatsoever in future government policies and politicians. These politicians, of course, can make these promises because, by and large, they're no longer in office at all to be accountable for them. And it's that removal of accountability from the action that has created this problem in the first place. You know, Obama gets this pass. He gets past one more, you know, re-election if he wins this November. And then, of course, what does he care if the projections in 5, 10, 20, 50 years are completely way off from what they were before? He's not held accountable for them at all. And the largely apathetic and asleep American citizenry does not take into account this historical pattern that we see over time and time again. It's the, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. The American people should be ashamed of themselves, because time and time again, they've been fooled into embracing and accepting these programs with a certain price tag, when the long-term data clearly shows consistently that the government programs are always going to cost far and away more than they were claimed to have ever, you know, that the projections ever showed when they were trying to be passed. So it's a consistent theme we see. We would hope, I think, that the American people would wake up for once and see that this pattern exists. That whole definition of insanity of doing the same thing again and expecting different results certainly applies here.
Yeah, the problem is an ethical one, though, at its core, isn't it? Because this, we've gotten into this way of being. It's this, like, the Tao of modern America, this way we are of kicking the can down the road. But that's wrong, man.
Right.
We're totally screwing our kids, the future. I mean, this is so ridiculous. And, I mean, it really is frustrating. What's frustrating to me probably the most about this, Connor, is that I think that we're the last in the line in the Ponzi screen, you know, in the pyramid scheme.
Right.
Before it collapses. That's
right.
My, like, I'm actually optimistic for the future because I don't think these kids are stupid anymore. I think that my generation and generations before have bought into it. But like you and me, I mean, you got a job. I've had jobs. I paid so much into Social Security, it makes me sick based off what my wages used to be. And I'm not going to get a dime of that back. That is fraud. I'm not going to get it back. That is fraud, and I won't be able to sue anybody.
And it's enslavement, too. I mean, we are financially, assuming there's no massive debt liquidation or collapse or the Ponzi scheme collapsing, assuming that things at least remain somewhat consistent at all, we are enslaving the rising generation. It is nothing more than financial slavery. I don't use that word lightly. Of course, it comes loaded with all sorts of historical connotation. But we are enslaving our children and our grandchildren, or I should say, the people and folks in Washington are enslaving.
Yeah, but
them.
Why? You know what? It's okay because we've been slaves, Connor, and they should be slaves. It's this slave morality that we've got going.
Well, and not only it's that people feel, of course, that they've paid into the system and therefore can be able to reap from that system. Right? I was made to suffer, therefore. Others should be made to suffer so that I can enjoy leisure in my old age or this prescription benefit or what have you. It definitely is a slave mentality, and I worry, I'm optimistic for the future. I said many times in your show, but to the extent that anything remains at all consistent, I worry about my children, having to do the same and getting no benefit or basically being completely stolen from to finance this type of stuff. And as we talk about these aliens, whether it's inflation or deflation, there's, severe economic change on the horizon, and it's being basically passed under the radar with all this flowery, fluffy, hey, let's help the poor people and universal health care coverage and no pre-existing conditions, when people don't see the financial elephant in the room, and that's extremely problematic for no other reason than people aren't preparing for the future, right? They're being sold a bill of goods. They're hearing from the mainstream media that are just regurgitating these estimates that the government are getting. They're not doing their due diligence and homework, and so they don't plan for the future. Of course, you and I can, maybe say, okay, we're a little bit more awake. We can have, some food storage or financial savings or what have you to ride out, severe economic circumstances in the future. But think of the massive majority of American people. I mean, you see even just inclement weather and store shelves are wiped out because people want, bread and batteries and toilet paper and water and all these things. You think of when you look in the past as well with drops in the stock market, with bad job figures coming out, bank runs. There is potential for severe panic among people who are completely unprepared, and I think it's largely because they don't have the information, whether they don't want it because it's inconvenient.
It's because of the philosophy. You're right, but it's because of the philosophy. It's this Tao of modern America, this way of kicking the can down the road. I don't need to prepare, Connor, because I was a slave and my children will be slaves. It's like how child abuse perpetuates itself. You know what I mean? Like, the parent got beat up by its parents, so it beats its own kids. I mean, somebody's got to break that cycle.
Well, I love the scene in The Matrix where I can't remember his name, but the guy wants to be reinserted into The Matrix.
Yeah.
He doesn't like reality so much that he knows it's a lie, but he loves the comforting lie, the taste of steak, the feelings that he had before. And I think we see people realize that these are uncomfortable truths. We talk about these aliens as hard as they are to imagine, but we need to contextualize them. We need to talk about them because these are numbers that are being put on the backs of our children and grandchildren.
Yeah, here's actually, you mentioned that movie. I just want to play this clip. I think it's so awesome right here. Hold on just a sec. I think this is like totally nails exactly what's going on.
The Matrix is a system, Neo. That system is our enemy. When you're inside, you look around, what do you see? Businessmen, teachers, lawyers, carpenters. The very minds of the people we are trying to save. But until we do, these people are still a part of that system, and that makes them our enemy. You have to understand, most of these people are not ready to be unplugged. And many of them are so inert, so hopelessly dependent on the system, that they will fight to protect it.
I mean, does that nail it or what?
That movie is far and away one of the best movies ever in its prophetic nature, and it's just pinpointing society, exactly what we're talking about here. And what I've said before is we have this interesting conundrum, you and I, is that our greatest potential for converts are our greatest enemies. It is, you know, these people who share this common belief in freedom and liberty, or claim they do, and yet sponsor these bad policies. They're the people we need to reach out to, realizing they're our enemies, but they are our potential converts.
Yeah, we're gently trying to unplug them, aren't we? Thanks, Connor. Great segment, buddy.